Welcome to the Writing Studio for the latest installment of our series entitled On Writing, in which we invite professional writers from inside and outside the Academy, from here at Vanderbilt and from abroad, to share with us their experiences as writers, the joys and pitfalls of the writing life, and their struggles and triumphs with the writing process. Last semester we had a science writer here with us. This semester we're blessed to have two poets with us. Catherine Wagner is here from Oxford, Ohio, where she teaches at Miami University. And next month we will have John Cady, who is a poet and also a philosopher. He'll be here from visiting us from Milwaukee. My name's Tom Orange, and I'm an assistant director here at the Writing Studio. So welcome. And we hope you will come back and see us again once this event is over. I think I'll just start off by saying a few words about Kathy's work, introduce her a little bit to you, and then the format that we follow in this series is Kathy and I will talk a little bit about writing. She's going to share a little bit of her work with us, and then we'll talk again, and she'll share some more work, and then we'll open up the floor for conversation. We'd encourage you to ask any questions that strike you along the course of our dialogue and along the course of hearing Kathy's work. So far, Kathy has authored two books of poems, Miss America and Macular Hole. And she's also co-edited a collection of poetry entitled Not for Mothers Only, Contemporary Poems on Child Getting and Child Rearing. Now, all three of these books are from a publisher called Fence Books, which I think has staked out an important place in contemporary American poetry. The Fence editorial team, on some level, has taken it upon themselves to in a sense, straddle the great divides in American poetry and between different camps, between so-called mainstream and so-called experimental camps. Fence has really tried to bridge that divide or ride the divide in a way. And so in a sense, sort of refused to be pinned down in a way. And I think this is an important effort to be made. And so I think Kathy's work finds a good home with Fence, in part because I find her work to be in the tradition of dissident poets, and this is a tradition that goes back at least to Emily Dickinson and maybe to our contemporaries such as Alice Notley. So this is a poetry as a response to the conditions of the world that refuses to accept the terms that we are given. And at the risk of being a bit chauvinistic, I want to even say that Kathy's poetry is sassy. It has sass, right? Now this is a loaded word because boys are rarely thought of to be sassy. This is almost always an attribute of girls and almost always a pejorative attribute. But I think we can turn this and make it a productive moniker. And what is sassing really? It's to talk back, right? If you look in the dictionary, it'll tell you it's to speak impertinently, right? And what is impertinent? Well, it's something that doesn't belong. It's something that's out of place. And I think given our situation in the world today, it's very important there are times when it is appropriate to sass and to talk back and to speak back to authority and to the conditions in which we find ourselves. But what's interesting, though, I think, is as I position Kathy's work this way, there's a sense in which, too, there's motherhood is very important to her work as well, as the collection of work that she co-edited dealing with motherhood, I think, speaks to that. And so I find there's this combination of sassing, which is some typically thought of as being something that children do, and then motherhood is an authority And in a way, Kathy's work embraces both of these contraries. And so she's at once the child who's talking back, but also the mother who needs to, whose place and position it is to discipline, but also to love and nurture and whatnot. So this is the kind of the context that I see Kathy's work coming in. And I'm hoping along the course of our discussion, there's many things we can talk about, and it's easy to get carried away. But we might come back to this paradigm that I'm constructing, or not, as the case may be. But I thought we could start just with real basic questions that I think writers always like to share with each other and with other writers. And that's the sort of, and you can phrase this a number of ways. How did you know when you were a poet, or when did you decide to become a poet, or maybe even just more basically, how and when did you get interested in writing as a career, as a profession, or just even as a personal interest?
Right. Being a poet is always really a strange thing to me. It always feels kind of imposed from the outside or mm-hmm. something like that, you know. I mean, even writing poetry feels that way to me. Well, you know, write in a notebook a little bit and see what happens, and maybe it'll be a poem. And maybe it won't. But if I think about it if I think about myself as a poet or as a things that I'm working on as poems, then they don't happen or they're pretentious or whatever. So try to avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
But I love poems. You know, I mean, I really like poems. That are even I like older poems. I like traditional poems. You know, all kinds of poems. So. In that way, I'm very into the poetry thing.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that I think a lot of the people that I think of as my peeps, you know, like sort of experimental poets, mm-hmm. are not very into. I think that goes to where poetry started to become an important thing for me when I was a kid. You know, I just mm-hmm. lines of it would get into my head just from some anthology,
mm-hmm.
And lines of Wordsworth or of Frost, and they stuck there, and I loved them. So I wanted to write poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, back when I was a kid, definitely.
So it sounds like you're saying it was something that caught your interest and that you wanted to contribute to, but that the profession or title of poet is something that you feel is artificial or imposed somehow. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I could come around to it from something else I just thought of. You know, because you brought up in a sideways way, I suppose, feminism.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school and college, and in grad school too, I had this really, really strong sense of the weight of all the books on the shelves by men, just kind of bearing down on me, and in this very uncomfortable way, and wondering how I could fit into that picture, and how I could speak in that way,
mm-hmm.
and also finding myself personally disturbed by certain stereotypical manifestations of poet behavior when I was in grad school, particularly.
Such as, or do we want to not go into that?
When I was at Iowa, where I did an MFA, there was a. It seems really backward, but it wasn't all that long ago. It was in the 90s, but you know, there was the male teachers would invite the male students to meet with them at bars for, you know, beers, and they would talk mm-hmm. about poetry. And that didn't happen with the female students, or if it did, it was an invitation to other sorts of behavior. And, you know, it was really clear-cut mm-hmm. that there was an old boys network that was developing before my eyes
mm-hmm.
that really, really bothered me. And I think I was lucky as a woman poet in that that women were becoming publishers much more at that time. There was sort of there were certain exemplary women publishers before that, and well before that,
mm-hmm.
but there seemed to be quite an explosion of them around when I started publishing, and including Rebecca Wolf Spence.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think I ended up somehow locking into various networks in a way that women of previous generations didn't have the opportunity to do. So it was almost like, oh, old boys network, see ya. Uh-huh. I have better things going on. You know, so it seems to be the case now that the networks that I have tapped into, that are, whether they're female networks or not. It doesn't seem like there's that problem is such a problem anymore.
Right, right. So that there's actually more outlets or avenues or forums or spaces for a woman now,
absolutely.
As you were coming up, than there may have been. Right. And I think, well, this is important, I find, too, I think, because it's we're immediately sort of getting into the social dimension of writing.
Right.
Right, and there's in contrast to the stereotype of the writer as the isolated genius, often his or her ivory tower, or in his or her slovenly garret, isolated from the world and yet offering for the world the fruits of his or her isolated genius, right? This may be the case in some isolated instances, but it's rarely the case in fact that writers and writing doesn't really often happen that way, and that the writing interacts on some level with the social. So that's certainly something I'm interested in, and I think we can talk more about.
I find the idea of the poet being inspired, you know, in some way from afar, kind of an embarrassing idea. I actually know this feeling of feeling like one is inspired, you know, that there's some force that's moving through you know, or there's a trance state that you can go into, and I think that's very real. But what troubles me about it is when it's interpreted as some kind of to have some kind of truth value, therefore, you know. So I like to tap into that, go into trance state to write, and I regularly do it, and I absolutely love it, and I want it to happen and try to use it, but I also want to be aware there when I'm sort of floating in that place that it's lots of it is complete bullshit and coming from various cultural constructs that I would like to interrogate. So I just want to call bullshit on it all the time, even when I'm in the trance state.
How do you, this sort of is more in the process vein, and this I think is useful too. I'm interested to stay there for a moment, because I think that's an interesting place where you're in that, for lack of a better word, inspired place or moment. I think, where do you feel like your practice differs from the convention or the stereotype? And
stereotype?
You talked about sort of like recognizing there's a sort of an awareness where you're recognizing that a certain amount of it is bullshit, you're willing to. Well, I guess go from there, right?
So the poet as seer idea, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think it's I think about a person like Alice Notley, who's definitely inhabiting that tradition, and she invests in it in order to provide a counterweight, I think, to a massive weight of give herself strength to be in opposition to the degree that she is. But I find it kind of scary that she goes so far over into investing herself in that mode, because what if she's wrong, or what if there's it sometimes worries me that she thinks that she's kind of figured it out sometimes, but I don't think that in practice, actually, as she's writing it, does work that way, because she's constantly questioning, what she's saying and calling bullshit on it. And I think that's the thing. And poet like Jack Spicer does the same thing. It's this, it might be coming from the Martians. This poet who believes he has an idea that the Martians are offering him the things that he's saying,
right.
He takes notes,
right. But, his poems really are given to him from some outside force, which he alternately identifies metaphorically or literally as Martians, as coming over the radio, right?
Yeah,
right.
But when you read the poems, it's clear that from line to line, he's criticizing what he's just written down. So the poems feel very alive because of that dialogic move from line to line.
Right.
And I feel like found that was a really, really productive thing for me to read and understand.
And I think that maybe pinpoints it for me a little bit in terms of the dynamic that I'm interested in is on the one hand, you have the sort of uncensored bullshit, right? But then there's the sort of having figured it out, right? And to me, that seems to be where the crux is, and that maybe the stereotypical inspired writer is the one who thinks they have figured it all out and right. therefore continues to spew BS.
That's what creates that mm-hmm. The tone that I find really horrific is mm-hmm. In certain kinds of poetry where there's this kind of like, and now we have arrived at the wisdom moment of the poem, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, right.
That
right.
I can't imagine how you would have how you would ever be able to put yourself in that position of being the wise one,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know.
So I guess what I'm trying to figure out then is how do you, it seems to me that it's a skill that one has to develop to recognize when the BS is BS and when you haven't figured it out yet and when maybe you think it may look like you have but you really yeah. haven't. And so can you speak to that sort of...
Yeah, I think it's really hard. It's an endless, mm-hmm. endless game, really serious game that you have to play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, back to Spicer. Spicer talks about this, that, you know, the Martians will tell him what to say, but it sometimes takes a really long time for him to filter through what the Martians have said
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
out from what he's saying, so maybe it'll take him an hour to write down a word or something like that. And then it begs the question, you know, how do you know when mm-hmm. it's the Martian? You know, how did you figure out that it was the Martian now, so that you can write that down?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think, you know, just have to sort of ride on some kind of bullshit detector, but then that even that bullshit detector turns into bullshit, and you have to, you know, point the finger at that.
Right, right.
And cut it down.
Right, right. So it's a constant monitoring and tweaking of the bullshit detector on some
yeah.
level, right?
Yeah. yeah. But I think that's a productive, that's a lot of where, if my poems ever have energy in them, that I think it comes from that
mm-hmm,
kind
mm-hmm.
of,
yeah,
push
yeah.
on whatever I just said.
Right. Let's think about this then in terms of your sort of practice, in terms of what you're actually doing at the computer or at your notebook.
Mm-hmm.
So does this mean that you do a lot of editing? What kind of editing, right? Do you do small-scale local revisions, or do you do massive sort of like just I need to get rid of these 10 pages or something
yeah,
like that?
I write a lot more than I ever keep,
mm-hmm.
I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the revision question is really hard to actually honestly talk about, because I found that when I'll have some kind of mythical idea of a poem based on the final draft of it,
mm-hmm.
I'll have some idea about it that is not true.
Mm.
You know, that I wrote it at a certain time, and I'll look back in my notebooks and I'll find out that actually I cobbled it together from three different places. Something like this, and then and then when the poem ends up having some kind of coherence to it, I then invent an origin myth for it. It's really strange.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I tell myself the truth about it, but
mm-hmm.
if I think about what I tend to spend time doing, I just read them again, and then I change everything in them, and then I go back and I realize that I've totally killed the poem. This is typical. I'll like kind of try to perfect it.
Mm-hmm.
And fix all sorts of problems with it, and that will kill it. This is true with essays too,
mm.
and I'll have taken the interesting stuff out of it. The energy will be gone somehow. So I'll have to go back in, and then I'll have to sort of drippily put back in little bits of it until it's sort of messed up again to feel like it has some energy again.
Uh-huh.
Or else maybe I'll just tear it in half and give it some other, you know, mash it together with something else.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
usually I work in series, so that. Then I have to be thinking about how the thing interacts with the series.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
it takes a long, long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
I do lots and lots of drafts.
And do things tend to sit a while before you revisit them? Do you sort of let them put them out of your mind for a while and revisit
yeah,
them later, or
I try
are you
to.
Kind of yeah?
I try to. I actually have a metaphor that I use with myself about this, which
mm-hmm.
is from the movie, the Will Smith movie, Independence Day.
Independence
Day.
Right, right.
Yeah, Independence Day. There were, if I remember it right, that you know, they have the alien and they're going to operate on the alien,
mm-hmm.
but they shouldn't really because they don't know how the alien works. You know, like you don't know where the alien's heart is, you don't know where its kidneys are. You might like cut off think that you're sewing up its finger, but actually
mm-hmm.
you've just cut off its left nut or whatever. And so you need to be really cautious when
uh-huh.
you're doing these things. And I think that you know, this is sort of borrowed from the Spicer model, but
mm-hmm.
the poem is like this alien, and you have to figure out what the hell it's doing before
mm-hmm.
you start
mm-hmm.
fucking with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. such bad language.
we can blip that out if need be, but I don't know. This certainly isn't, the FCC is not going to worry about it too much, I don't think.
I think that's one good reason to just wait, because, you know, there are lots of unconscious things going on. I do think that, you know, your brain does lots of things without your that are going to be smarter than what you can do on your own. So you have to wait and see what the smartness is before you go and fixing it with your current level of smartness.
Because if you don't wait, you might go in there and cut out the brain or something like that. And then you have Frankenstein, and what can you do with that except try to get a brain from some other...
There's this constant experience of fixing it and thinking, what happened? It's dead. What did I do?
Okay.
Yeah, so I actually don't have time to revise like that anymore. I used to go in way sooner than I should have and just get obsessive with it, but it seems like I just put things away for a long time now.
Mm-hmm. Do you write on the computer or do you write by hand?
I never write on the computer.
Really?
Never, never, never.
All by hand?
Yeah.
In what kind of notebooks?
I used to be sort of obsessive notebook, just like a marble notebook. I don't like fancy notebooks because I feel precious. Mm-hmm. But my marble notebook. And then after I had Ambrose, my son, who's 4 now, I had hardly any time to write, and my writing process had to adjust a good deal. Mm-hmm. And I started having an upstairs notebook and a down and out notebook. Mm-hmm. Like, so that does say, there's a notebook that says down and out. Mm-hmm. And that notebook stays downstairs and it goes out. And then there's another one that's upstairs.
Goes out, where?
Well, it stays in my bag. It goes in my bag.
Oh, okay. Downstairs and out of the house. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Not like this is the one I use when I'm down and out.
No. Okay. Although sometimes,
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. And so then I just take that. And my notebook is just a catch-all kind of place. It lists and, you know, weepy missives to myself and whatever, you know, whatever goes in there.
So then at what point do you transfer stuff to the computer wholesale, or do you do a lot of editing / composing in the computer as well?
Well, after the notebook is just the composition stage, and then I never rewrite anything in the notebook, then it goes onto the computer.
Okay.
So at some point after a few months, I'll take a couple of notebooks and I'll go to the computer and I'll read through it and I'll dog-ear all the pages that I want to type up and I'll type them all up without thinking about it at all. Mm-hmm. And then I'll print it all out and then I'll forget about it for a little while and then I'll read it all over.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, since we're sort of in the process vein, I wonder if you might want to tell us a little bit about how you decide on a certain project or how certain projects or ideas come to you. And you might do this as a way of segueing into a selection that you want to read.
Oh, sure. Well, I do like series.
Mm-hmm. You want to explain a little bit what you mean by that?
Coming up with some sort of either formal or content-based or some other kind of project, maybe it's just a title, something like that, and then I'll just work on it for a while. Mm-hmm. What it does is it's a freeing up device. Mm-hmm. It sort of takes a little pressure off so that not every poem needs to be the end-all, be-all, wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. But it also gives me a little time to kind of work something out that I might want to worry for a while and just chew on and see what happens with it. And if I have it in mind as a series, and as opposed to, say, thinking of it as a long poem, although I'm starting to work on long poems more, or as a single poem, then I can just let it kind of morph as it goes along and find out what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And an example of that, what I've done a bunch of them, one I'll mention was Fraction Anthems. That was one of the first ones that I did like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my first book. And the idea with Fraction Anthems, which came from the term I saw in a, not a hymnal, but a sort of order of prayer kind of book, and I don't remember what kind of church I was in going to a concert. And so I thought, that's an interesting title. So I started writing Fraction Anthems. And the idea with the Fraction Anthems was a sort of PN2... I was trying to write down everything that was going on in the moment. It was totally an impossible thing to do. So just like, all right, I'm going to sit here, I'm going to write down everything that's happening. And that includes in my head and maybe other places in the world and just everything. See if I could do it. And obviously that's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the idea. So I sit down.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then I ended up going back through those poems and doing this kind of number, pulling out of words from the poems with my social security number, because I thought that the poems were really I-based, and I-based in terms of me being the sort of a sort of centripetal or centrifugal force in these poems. And I thought that the social security number, which originates elsewhere but means me and without which I cannot exist, is would be an interesting thing to do, you know, process these poems to see what words came out. And it was really funny what happened. In at least some cases, the notes, as they ended up being notes, seemed to really criticize what I was saying in the poems, and I really enjoyed that. So one of the notes says something like, I, a big I. You know? It's really goofy things like that that do seem to directly address what I was, the self-interestedness of the poems. So that was one. Then another one was the exercise poems, which I did because I was having a big back problem, and every morning and night I had to do these really boring back exercises and sets of them. So I started this series where really lackadaisically I would write a line between every set. And I did this for maybe 3 years and ended up with a lot of writing. Most of it just completely boring. And I ended up, you know, cutting out a lot of the lines and then publishing a couple of chapbooks of it. I think that's going to be in my new book, even though it's now a really old project. And those ended up having this weird choppy effect and also were very much about the body. Developed this theme that I didn't plan at all, but ended up just being about body in many, many ways that I now find interesting.
And is that slated to be in your next book too? You think
that is? Okay. And then another one like that is everyone in the room is a representative of the world at large, which is this chap that came out not too long ago, and it's. That unwieldy title came into my head at some point when my son was really small, and I wanted to write. I couldn't find any time to write at all. It was driving me nuts. And so I thought, all right, I'm going to figure out a way to do this. I'm going to write poems only with other people in the room. That's what this project is going to be. Write everyone in the room is a representative of the world at large at the top of the page, and write a poem, and somebody else has to be in the room when I do this. And normally that would be my son, but sometimes it would be other people. And it turned out that project, as soon as I could divorce myself from that project, I did, because I found it really unpleasant and difficult. But it was really useful, and the poems did end up having... what's interesting to me about doing series like this, especially process-based series that do incorporate something about my environs and what's happening in life and experience in some way, is that the form ends up creating meaning in some way. And in the Everyone in the Room poems, what ended up happening was that I was constantly thinking about the other person and other people while I was writing the poems, so that they ended up, even if I didn't mention the person at all, they ended up having some social awareness in them, and they ended up being really political, because the poems are all about, they ended up being all about power, because when I'm in the room with my son, I realized that I had an immense amount of power over him, and he had a crazy amount of power over me, and it made me think a lot about other kinds of power relationships. So yeah, it was, that was totally unexpected that series ended up being about power.
Yeah. Do you want to share some with us from that or from...
I can read a couple of them. I was going to read the fucking series first, and then read the other ones later.
Sure.
Is that okay?
As you wish, yeah.
All right, so I'll read some of these from a new chapbook called Hole in the Ground. I had my second book is called Macular Hole, and it's really embarrassing to have another book with hole in the title, especially about...
How long have you been having these horrible thoughts?
Yeah, so there we go, you know, it's like maybe I'll get over it someday. All right, so this is a series I became obsessed with, thinking that I should write about fucking, so I started. There we go. The first poem is called The Argument, and it's mostly quoted from this book called Hypnerotomachia Polyphily, which is, in English, it was a book from the 1400s, and
something about many loves in that last
right many
part.
Loves, and it's translated into English not quite rightly as the strife of love in a dream.
The hypnosis, the dream part.
Yeah. Right. So I borrowed a lot from that in this section. The argument. This book is called Hypnerotomachia Fuckphila. Fuckphila on her journey, her new spelling, reminiscent of Chick Fil A. Fill the chick and fill her well of ding ding dong. Fucking A. Behold a useful and profitable book. If you think otherwise, do not lay the blame on the book, but on yourself. If you sourly refuse the new erotic guest, do not despise the well-ordered sequence, nor the fine, well-ordered style. Then in this volume, she falls in love. It is a worthy book, and full of many ornaments. He who will not read it is dull of mind. Various things are treated in it, which it would tire me to relate, but accept the work which offers a cornucopia emending it, should it be incorrect. The end. There actually is supposed to be, when this project is finished, which is not yet, a cornucopia emending the project, which is a lot of interviews with people. I've sent out a survey, and I'm doing interviews with homeless people about sex. And somehow or another, I'm supposed to incorporate this into this project, but I don't know quite how yet. So this is just the poems that I've written for the project. Okay, for the boys. Can you imagine, dear men, what it is to be a woman being fucked? The men installing a new gate ran past them, prickling, face prickling, back of neck, sensitive and tight. And they do say something, too, about me. Now there was, in a transparent skybox, someone watching my body and giving it a score. I berated myself for letting it hover. Then the man in the orange construction helmet crashed through the skybox glass with his head, and the transparent box filled with color and a stone support under it. I did not make it up. Will you just fuck me, or will I just fuck without the skybox? There is no fucking without the skybox. This part is for girls, college high school girls. The guy fucks you 5-8 minutes, you think you were supposed to come, you do not. What's wrong with you, Frigidaire girl? But prior girl came all the time. To have to learn to be pleasing throws his image as successful lover, image he needs to continue sexing, in doubt. The problem lies with you. This situation, lie on both sides, is the rule. There are exceptions. Now let us have ceremonial sex. Who is the pauper? I will be. This one's called, well, in your chasm of faith opportunity tree, why don't you cramp on up? Down by the bay, where the watermelons grow, back to my home, I dare not go, for if I do, my mama might say, did you ever see an ostrich stapling with a boss stitch? Down by the bay, can you see my home, where my mama say roam, and if I do, my mama might say some. Where a place for us, a little stapled us. This one has various quotes from Thomas Wyatt. De profundis clamavi, or did I seek? The fucking isn't interesting. The fucking is friction. The friction is two surfaces in contact and moving. The depths I clam from, out of the depths I cling to you, O penis, wispy, nispy, nispiness. I charge my galley with forgetfulness. A galley is a rowed ship, rowed by slaves. If I could be not revolted, could hold my vomit in, I'd love to fuck a disgusting body, whether it were the person's will or not, and against my will. Like a hole in the ground, I would root that mountain down. Root it down so far the hole's dismantled. Or continue to allow the whole hole to be filled with an instability, the wavering penis. Wavery, sweet, and blind. Oh, come on up. Welcome, welcome, my one true love. Welcome, welcome, said she. I trawled my love through a half a dozen maids, and I laid him at the bottom of the sea. Fallacious equals fellatio plus delicious. But is delicious. Cut grass and oysters. Beachy head. If unpleasant, against the rear throat. The gag reflex you learned to control in high school. Terrify all comers. This one's a little bit of relief from all that kind of thing. The young assistant to the director of sacred music at the Yale Divinity School. His name is Jim. He plays country music on his guitar. He shops for guitars but does not buy them. It is a pleasure to see the fine guitars and marvel at the price tags. The assistant to the director of sacred music has large eyes, green or blue. When people are shopping for guitars and you are on the escalator at MoMA in New York, assessing your claustrophobia and why the art in the building is drained of root or intention, you have a job and a child, or on vacation from the job, the child's with his dad. You are in a museum inhabiting a body that used to go to museums and rattle with awe. It is uncomfortable that the rattle is still. And Jim calls you. You met on the train from New Haven. He's a little short. You like tall men. You're not alone. Light colors, black-rimmed, attract your notice. There's mascara for that, or dark long lashes and Italian boy brows. This is a fucking poem. Don't expect too much. Well, I expect you to go into the fucking human tunnel. I'm going. Pink, grimy, glossed, and tabulature, welted and tattooed, and folded in ropey ceiling hangings. But it isn't a room, and bumblingly sliding out, little legs of a little girl, bum on the wall, opening, pink legs sticking out like a hermit crab's. She's coming. Shutter out, the little girl, legs with a little girl, head, mostly eyes, no ears, bug brain, aimless. Send her to school. It's cold, and where should she go? She will eat her legs with her mandibles. Her eyes will retract inside. Stroke her riding hood. Settle down, little. Nobody will hurt you by breaking off your little legs, six little legs, if you come. This one, which is called Coming and I Did Not Run Away, has words that are spelled with a UT at the end, like gut and shut, but they're spelled with an umlaut over the U, so I'm pronouncing them in the way that I want to be in between, like gut, for example, in between gut and good. Coming and I Did Not Run Away. Still not finished review, but productive day and feeling good, like a fine mama should, putting down some roots like the last queen, toot, 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 toot. Brand spanking hanky panking new periodical in my uterus. Yes, I cried, thought I was going nutso. Not so, ah so, yes, it was just a periodical, making me illogical. Not wrong, though, I was not wrong. I saw the usual turn of phrase, coming, and I did not run away. I lay around. And this is called X, and it's spelled X, the letter, and most of the time when it comes up in the poem, I pronounce it like, you know, kiss, kiss. I wish I wanted to sleep with you. Your equation is simple. I can form an X shape, ready to embrace you with arms and legs, signed U, comfortably at the bottom of the page. Oh, the radio half-life of my space in your equation sings a song you half hear. Any part of me that accepts your cock is an X part. Arctic radio that freeze-dries you with its song. A nest of yellow jackets on the west wall of my rental. They don't die when they sting you. Bottom-barbed, fuzzy-headed, angry from way back. You are very large, full of air, and tied to the top of a building. Plenty of people will blow hot air up your pants leg. My other half-life is not X anything. Garbled between stations, heard inside your cell as message, a radio half-life you could barely understand, profoundly and forever, unslept with by you. The equation's parts reduplicate around the X, which holds you off at arm's length. Oh, no one's nice that doesn't want something from you. Oh, hand him a photocopy of what he wants. I'm lit from below by the copier light. No one looks good lit from below. But I need to make a copy of my satapon for you to fold and airplane. I'll read one more of these. Bridge or Tunnel, which is a New York poem. Buy me dinner, pay the toll. Buy me dinner, pay the toll. Are you taking the bridge or the tunnel? Oh, the tunnel. The lights are fluorescent. You can't listen to the radio. An urrrrng sound reverbs. Stay in lane. It's not sexy. Though the risk, perhaps, your head all the way underwater. Stay in lane to the light at the end of the tunnel equals orgasm? Your orgasm determines when the sex is over. Pass him paying the toll on the other side of the road. Easy pass means they pay later. Or the bridge over the pubic bone in salt air. That's better. A swooping feeling. The suspension. But when do you go inside? There's a hole in the middle of the bridge? Nothing so frightening. You could go in the water. But please keep running over me. Soft wheels on either side divided highway. You're going to make me scream inside my head.
Great, thank you. That makes me want to talk about feminism, if I dare. I guess that was the unspoken word until you spoke it earlier. But maybe even putting that question aside, maybe, given what you described before about the challenges, that the unique challenges that face women writers, whether it's in terms of breaking through, establishing networks that aren't available, opportunities that aren't available, challenges that men don't have to face. Maybe I would put it the question less in terms of are you a feminist or would you consider that a feminist text, but what kind of activism is proper today to, I don't want to say proper in the sense that there's one thing that everybody should do, but I guess what activist potential is there for a writer who happens to be a woman? Like, are we sort of in a phase where we don't need to, a sort of post-feminist phase, or is there, are there things that women writers can do to address imbalances in society and whatnot?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a really big question, right? Mm-hmm. That lots of poets that I know struggle with all the time, which is, you know, can poetry be activist in any way? And in what way is it effectively so? And, you know, and it always often seems to come down to some kind of question that I'm not sure is really a good question about whether, about, you know, some sort of direct speaking to an audience that will understand what you're saying, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. versus interrogating the forms with which we speak, you know, mm-hmm. which come from various cultural imperatives. So if we don't interrogate those, then we're just falling into various traps. But if we sit around interrogating them, then nobody will understand what the hell we're saying, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this endless sort of dichotomy, and mm-hmm. it doesn't seem to me to be that useful. Because there's no, I don't think you can go, you just can't get anywhere with it.
Yeah, I
think that, and I guess my way of, I don't think this was exactly your question, mm-hmm. but I don't know how to imagine poetry being activist in any large way, just because mm-hmm. people don't read it most of the time. But the other thing that seems to me to be really true is that mm-hmm. I feel incredibly affected by what poetry does. You know, mm-hmm. when I read it, it does a lot of things to my head. So
right.
why shouldn't it have an effect?
Right.
And it seems equally nonsensical to take the W.H. Auden position of, you know, that it accomplishes nothing,
right.
as it does to make ludicrous claims for its
right.
efficacy.
Maybe I'll put it this way. If that chapbook were to happen to appear at a bookshelf in Borders or Barnes & Noble's,
uh-huh.
With the words women's studies or women's writing, women's
right.
writing, would that upset you? Would you be okay with that?
What
other possibilities for it would you want? Would that be
right.
limiting?
I mean, it is this annoying de facto thing that happens with, you know, if you put those words on it, then
right.
then a large segment of people are probably never going to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hope not. I mean, one thing I've noticed about Alice Notley's books is that, and she's absolutely one of my favorite poets, is that the last whole bunch of her books have blurbs from men on them, usually three
mm-hmm.
different men,
mm-hmm.
and no women. And notably on the back of Disobedience, there were three men who blurbed it, and they two of them used the word engaging about her work,
mm-hmm.
which is a word that she made fun of being used about her own work and
mm-hmm.
about other women poets' work.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's sort of one of those sassy type words.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't these, you know, isn't it nice that these women just try to call you in and make you feel welcome,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, you know, you talked about the word engaging. Was it a joke? Did you set it up with these guys? And she said, no.
That's the vocabulary they came with. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Right.
yeah.
That's right. So, but I think it's interesting that she makes this, it seems to me to be a choice to situate herself. She wants the men to listen to her.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, you know. Check it out. I'm
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. I'm in the middle of the shelf, and I'm going to take up a whole bunch of it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that, you know. And I feel like there's that men read my work, at least, you know, four of them or something.
mm-hmm.
And I want them to, definitely. I feel like that book's almost to men in a way. It's like
mm-hmm.
definitely aimed at them.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting if that were actually shelved under men's studies.
Right, right.
right. Even right. though it equally applies on some level, right? Right.
Yeah. 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 But at the same time, I do think that that there has been some use in women's studies and in women's anthologies and
mm-hmm.
things like this to
mm-hmm.
Have a place for a go-to place for people to look for work, and then, you know, hopefully it'll come up and it'll become part of the rest of the world.
Right.
I don't know if that answers what you were saying.
Yeah. No, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think we officially have about 30 more minutes, but we started late, so I think if we go a little bit late, that seems to me okay. And I certainly want to turn the floor over to our audience, to our listeners, to join the discussion, go back to points we talked about earlier, raise new points, as you wish. But I also want you to know, Kathy, that if you want to read a few more poems, certainly take whatever opportunity you see fit to go ahead and do that. I think we'd like to hear more as well. So I just throw things open to the audience, see if there's anything that's on your mind that you want to pose? Join the discussion in any way? Yeah, in the back.
I thought that the last piece actually, as much as or more than about being about feminism or being a feminist text, was sort of an interrogation of metaphor or just like a thinking through of automatic references.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk maybe about that? Because it definitely seems like you're, and like even when you were talking, like that's something that you're thinking about.
Well, I guess you're talking about sort of catchphrases or given language that just kind of
or
come...
Or even just, you know, like holes and tunnels and, I mean, you're really like going kind of whole hog, if you will, like...
H-O-L-E hog, that's me.
I mean, you know, you really are, like, exploiting it to its fullest extent.
Yeah.
And it seems purposeful. And so that's, I guess...
Yeah, I guess so. I really like, you know, figuring out, kind of grabbing onto whatever imagery comes up and kind of feeling like a bulldog with it and seeing what happens with it. So, yeah, I guess so. That poem does feel very, it's kind of organized. Like, first we talk about the tunnel and now we will talk about the bridge, you know. Yeah, and as a metaphor for sex. I don't know what to say exactly. One thing that comes to mind is that that it does seem to me, I'm not sure this is what you're talking about, but that certain phrases, received phrases, will come to mind around particular metaphors or sets of images, and then I just let them in there and then try to see what I can, but not just let them be whatever they were, kind of push on them and process them and see, make them do something.
Right. Like, it seems like that would happen in a poet's process, you know, and then, but with an act of resistance, that person would go, oh no, I can't use that, obviously.
Uh-huh.
And so what I noticed is, like, you're saying, no, I'm going to use that because it came here, and so, but you transcend it. It, you know, you transcend its, like, unoriginality.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I feel like that would be making too big of a claim or something for what I'm doing, what I did. But yeah, just sort of. I like having those. I like having little pieces of cheap language in the poems, and then having them be something else as well. Because it gives. It's part of that messy thing that I like to preserve. It lets things be multi-layered, but it also creates a certain tone, you know, that the poem is involved in the world, I suppose, and isn't objecting to the world or claiming for itself that it's at a higher level.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? Other contributions to the discussion? Yes.
It seems to me that one of the really neat things about hearing you read your own work is hearing the way in which singing and rhythmic and other kinds of, like, speed sorts of decisions are at stake there. And I wonder how much you're thinking about that when you are in the business of composing it.
Uh-huh.
So are you sort of fitting the bits together, and then you sort of read it and try out the way in which you want it to sound?
I do try to score the poems on the page in some way or another, and I'm doing it more than I used to, I think, and maybe better than I used to, I hope. But I definitely hear a certain rhythm, and I want it to go onto the page. And then reading can be really hard, because when you read, you do have to almost choose a particular interpretation of a poem and put it forward, because the way that you phrase something might really change it. So I either have to try to find some in-between way to preserve some ambiguity, or just choose one. Like, this is the performance version. So I do that. Yeah. And I've moved further and further in the direction of the singing and the, you know, speeding up and slowing down and things like that.
Have you ever heard someone else read your work about?
No, I don't think I have. Yeah, I probably should have somebody just sit there and read it to me so that I can hear what they're interpreting the pauses to be. Mm. Yeah, because I do think of it as scoring.
Do you think in terms of voice? Like, do you find or do you strive to attain a certain voice or kind of voice, or is it a matter of allowing voices to emerge? Come and go, and if so, how do you decide? What helps you decide the voice to keep versus the voice to reject?
Oh, gosh.
It's kind of a traditional kind of, you know, voice is a kind of a traditional concept,
yeah.
But I feel like something like it might be present in those poems. And
yeah, mm. Those poems seem to have a sort of a speaker, or at least a central kind of emotional attitude or
mm-hmm.
something like
mm-hmm.
that. Yeah. I don't know. Because I definitely, I don't feel like they're persona poems
mm-hmm.
in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't want it to feel like, I mean, it might feel speechy in some ways, but
mm-hmm.
I definitely wouldn't I don't want it to feel like a delivered speech or a monologue
mm-hmm.
or something like that that's all spoken. I'd like it to have various levels to it, or like this could be a thought, or this is an interjection of some sort, or
mm-hmm.
This is a different kind of, this is on a different register, this isn't voiced.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I want to have that stuff be available in the poems. You know, when there's singing that comes in, I don't know who's doing the singing exactly.
Mm.
That's like a, more like, more like a live collage or something,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
an audio collage maybe.
Yeah, how did that passage come to you as song? Did it come to you as song?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And the song I write haven't so much lately, but I write a lot of songs.
Mm-hmm.
To you know, some stupid pop song or whatever will be in my head, and I will just write the right words to it.
Mm-hmm.
That happens a lot,
mm-hmm.
and they're usually really simple melodies, nothing very interesting.
Because it sounded almost as if that could have been, or maybe you were trying to render it as a kind of a folk ballad or something like
that.
Oh yeah,
there. Well, in the two, I think, places that I sang, I don't know, I think that's it,
mm-hmm.
a hole in the, where I said, like a hole in the ground.
Right.
That's a famous folk song called Mole in the Ground. Do you guys know that? It's like a mole in the ground, I would root that mountain down. I wish I was a mole in the ground. And that's why I titled the manuscript that, because I really like the idea of the hole as a, you know, let's face it, metaphor for vagina
mm-hmm.
and for feminine sexuality
mm-hmm.
Being something that could possibly root the mountain down
mm-hmm.
and do some kind of seismic activity and really change things,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that, hence that. That song, and then the other one is it's actually on the Harry Smith anthology. The other one that I sang, yeah.
Which one was that?
Do
you remember?
It's well met, my one true love.
Okay.
Well met, said she. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So. Do you want to? Anything else you don't want to read for us?
I could. What are you? It's almost. Five, I don't know. What do you think of like 15 minutes, or is that too long? Okay.
I'd love to hear more.
I see mostly nods of head and affirmative.
Right.
So
awesome.
Well,
I'll read two quick ones. So you can hear a little bit of what this is like. Because I wanted to, because I talked about that power thing. I'll just read one from this one actually.
And again, this is. Everyone in the room is a representation of the world at large.
Is a representative of the world
representative.
At large. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the room is a representative of the world at large. Your servant, this is my son's name is Ambrose, and his name comes up in the poem. Your servant and oppressor, son. I permit your blossoming along the sticks inserted in your brain. Socialize, intellectualize, capitalize. Socialization implies original sin. Play Ambrose as a rack. I'm mighty, and I'll direct him polite before he interferes. Dear other nations, your servant, USA Catherine Ann, I'll tidy up your house to look like mine. You're free now, it'll be me. There's no analogy. Iraq's dictator was evil. Baby's not evil. But Iraq's dictator was naughty, and the baby wants things he should not have. There's my analogy. I have learned best. I'm free, right, and point a gun. A stupid pun can't end this section. A stupid cunt can. Bye. So, and then I wanted to read this new-ish poem called My New Job. It's a little bit long, but I shouldn't take, I think it takes 9 minutes to read.
Does it need any preface, or do you want to just go straight in?
I think I'll just go straight in.
Okay.
My New Job. I am invested in by a huge fund. Heavy, high quality furniture. Sense of heavy. Addiction, glossy pleasance. I was lying down on a yoga mat, and my body was skinnier, skinnier even than before. My bones basketing air, barely draped in skin, the basket effulged by local air. High quality scented, humid air to support my orchid skin. Suffused in this air, expense, I nearly floated, who was my body. I am comfortable. I am comfortable. Flying my spirit on a long leash. She is in the wind. I am in the bell jar. Shellacked and brittle begins to ding. How can I, from inside this comfort, represent, hope to represent? No, must leave this. I am too tempted to think I deserve it. I must rigidly and with effort know my privilege. I know my fluorescent doorway, a rectangle among the ceiling tiles, ordinary flecked-coated one foam rectangles, and one hard white light regularly rubbled to glass rectangle. These are my choices. The ceiling tile I would tear in behind the ugly lattice to the duct area, unscrew the grill, small in myself into the dark square cold pipe to share my cold, what is in my bone basket, with the other breather workers. Or through the fluorescent door means giving up on going behind the lattice. All that's allowed through the flow light is what is shine upon. The light bends looking at my skin and hair and green blouse. When I concentrate, the light bending all at once hooks my outsides, hooks them into itself. Now I am absent that. I am not shined upon. I am very small, dusty, lizard-like, a toad, a turd, on a tabletop corner. And the outside of that is hooked away. Wow, my parents hooked away. People on the street hooked away. Skin and clothing hung on hangers, hung from electric wires, blooming and twisting, swells of breeze leave behind on the street. A fair weather, an easy weather walk through. I think I'm better than the walkthroughs, because something is left of me. That's what I think. I think I must be wrong to think so. Would you like to eat at my house? Fill up your walkthrough? You drive through, fill it up with tea and sheets, water from the toilet. These could be your eyebrows, crayons. These could be your knees, these coasters. What could be your inside? Paper. wadded paper. It says something. What about something sticky for your mouth, honey? Then we will read you for dinner. In my transitional housing, dirt ball toad, I picked myself apart with a fork, connected a wire to myself, coiled up the plug at my center. The prongs poke hurt where my belly was, the inside of my belly. I wish this part of me were hookable. This is the part light plugs into. My, the outside, plugs into to light up. The shine is from unshiny. There is retaliation thrashing at the container. This is not lookable at. This is trying to get out. So I was trying, my lizard turd was trying to join the other mud, sewn in place with the little... Oh, excuse me, this is mine. How annoying. It's on silent. Sorry, guys. All right, I'm sorry. My lizard turd was trying to join the other mud, sewn in place with the little light hooks, made a case for me visible. And I retaliated against the hooks. My thrashing, harnessed, motored, made the light. Meanwhile, my toad absorbed pollution, sucked wandering thought from the walkthroughs. High, empty thoughts, funneled back channel, sucked down to me. Won't you be mine, mind? Be my thought, softening the rock mud. I will reorient now. I will claymation. That is a scary, gingerbready mud man walking. You can't catch me. A hole for your thoughts. Chased, chased by your old thoughts. Tunneled invisible. Unreflecting. Once, not repeated, reflected, or represented. Not wrapped. The sun is here. Also, later and at the same time, the sun burned up and we revolved around it. Dirt rock. Warm dirt rock. In the dark. Of coursing around the dark. I have made myself the center of the galaxy. I am very important to myself. Must lose this visibility. The shine is off. Perspect while kicking. Where do you think they get the lights from? Burn it up. Burn up all the fuel into furious dirt. Nematodes don't need light. When I am in a room with forest, it is not that myself comes home to myself. Selva oscura, yeah. Obscurity of self. I considered long and seriously before I was born. I stood on the street with the hookers who were selling disappear into a hole, into mama, but come back out. Go in, boys. Go in and stay there.
Thank you. Do you have any advice for writers who would like to find their way into the publishing world, into the world of print?
Yeah, I think it's something that is a. It was something I was really worried about and concerned about for a long time, and then when I started being published, I immediately stopped worrying about it, and thank God, you know, because it's such a pain in the ass thing to worry about and think about. It's much more interesting to focus on writing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how did that transition happen for you? Was it
getting published?
Yeah.
You know, I started reading magazines that were publishing work that I liked mm-hmm. and sending to them, and they published me. Mm-hmm. It was really simple. Mm-hmm. I wasn't reading the right magazines for a while, and mm-hmm. then I found magazines that I thought were fantastic, and then, you know, it was all set, seemed like. I don't know if it was exactly that easy, but it seemed like it was.
How did you find those magazines?
That was hard, actually.
Accidental or
it was accidental. There was a guy named George Herbert, not the
17th century
not the 17th century
Anglican.
Yeah. But he was the manager of the university bookstore at the University of Iowa, and he was really interested in kind of experimental avant-garde poetry magazines, and they were on a very low shelf in a very strange corner of the library, but there were lots and lots of them, and mm-hmm. I read them all the time, mm-hmm. and, you know, sent work to those. Mm-hmm. And, people at those liked my work better than the other people did, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. seemed like, or at least would write back to me, which is actually, I find, much more pleasurable than getting accepted, and certainly, getting accepted is the best part, and having a negotiation with the editor, when the thing actually appears in the magazine, I don't want to look at it at all, I find it completely unbearable to see my work in magazines.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I kind of like that part.
Yeah.
Because then I can read it as if it's like, oh, this is just a poem by some guy.
Oh, you know,
some other guy.
Sort of like, do-do-do. Yeah.
And then I look and I laugh. I'm like, oh, what a clown. This guy. This is hilarious. What does this guy think he's doing here? Well, maybe if you could speak to the, maybe not so much that change from unpublished to published, but the change from anxious to not anxious.
Well, I don't think that anxious ever goes away, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mean, the desire to be loved, and, you know, I think writers all want to be adored, and, mm-hmm. you know, what can you do? But, and besides, just, I don't know. And then ambition is really tricky. I've started to think that why bother pretending that I'm not ambitious, you know? That I might as well just accept it and then just think about it and see where it's going and maybe why I'm ambitious and what's going on. Is it, you know, and hope that I'm ambitious for something decent. But mm-hmm. but I think it might be indecent, and maybe I can't help it. And if I can't help it, then why not just kind of mm-hmm. go for it and see what happens?
What kind of answers come to mind when the question of why am I ambitious?
Why am I ambitious?
Because I imagine different answers come to that question, and I wonder, can you give us some examples and maybe...
Well, I mean, I guess part of ambition would be to be like people that I really admire, you know, writers that I really admire who've made a massive difference to me.
Be liked by them.
No.
Be like them.
Be like them.
Okay.
Yeah, and do for the world in some way what I feel like they've done for the world, you mm-hmm, know. Mm-hmm. And that feels really overweening and ridiculous to imagine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, why not? And then the other side is just, you know, be universally adored and have people lick my armpits instead of having to take showers or whatever. I don't know.
There's always that.
Yeah. And that doesn't seem like a very good reason to be.
Right.
But, you know, it's nice to have friends. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to have work out in the world, I think the best thing about having work out in the world is the increase of community that you can have. Developing correspondence with people and loving their work and having them enjoy your work and, you know, going mm-hmm. back and forth and arguing about stuff. That's the best, mm-hmm. I think.
So, we're back to the social dimension and the sort of...
Yeah.
If you're holed up in your apartment or your house and you're with your laser printer,
right.
blind submitting to every magazine that you can find out about,
I try to talk to younger poets about it, that it's really, you know, a lot of times they'll say, well, I really want to publish. I'll say, well, is that really what you want, or do you want to join a community? Do you want to mm-hmm. be part of community? And, you know, you can start a magazine, or you can get involved with magazines that you enjoy, or locate a like-minded people through that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's where it feels warm and good.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? Questions, comments, objections, suggestions?
Sneezes. Shifting of body parts. Is it ready to move?
Ready to move to the reception table, perhaps. Well, I guess then we should probably conclude. I certainly want to thank Jennifer Holt and our director and Morgan Loper, our office manager, for their support and assistance in bringing this event to you. And again, stay tuned for next month in On Writing. We'll feature John Cady, a poet and philosopher from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I guess then we should thank Kathy Wagner for making the trip to Vanderbilt.